So for most of the talk today, I'd like to do Q&A like John does. There was something on my mind from yesterday's Dharma talk that I had wanted to start out with, which was the idea of bowing. And because I see that some people in the room are bowers, probably some out of the meaning of the action, probably some because everybody else is doing it. And there's some conscientious objectors, and I used to be a conscientious objector, so COs have my full sympathy. and so I think that if any part of these rituals doesn't have meaning to you, or doesn't have function for you, being a conscientious objector is the way to go. I actually have come to love bowing. I don't quite know how I feel about it in the group format where we all do it together, but sometimes I like to sneak in here at night and bow in front of the Buddha. There's so many different ways you can talk about the purpose of the path, or maybe they say the fruits of the path. But one of the ways you can talk about it is, it usually feels like you are this character in here behind your eyes, and you are the one deciding what your body should do, and you are the one in charge. And if you feel like this, life is pretty unpleasant, because you're learning over and over and over again that you are not the one in charge. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I'm guessing if I wanted to know how many of you decided to stop thinking about sex and or food at some point in this retreat and found that you were not in control of your mind, I'm going to guess that all the hands in the room would probably go up. Hopefully it's not just me. And so, to me, the act of bowing is certainly not subservience to Siddhartha Gautama, who, you know, historically the best we can say about him is he was probably a person. And it's certainly not an act of deference to, you know, a living person. But more so, when you can, for any period of time, get beyond the illusion of the self and the driver's seat of the mind, you get to see what lies beyond there. And the Buddha wouldn't really talk much about what lies beyond there. But one way you could think about it is it's much, much, much bigger, you know? That this guy, this girl sitting behind your eyes is, I don't know, 0.1% of your mind. That puts on this great smoke and mirrors show saying it's the whole thing, so don't look at the rest of the mind. This is what's going on here. Or we can get a slightly better model, you know, the mind system model. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of different minds in here, but I'm the president. I'm the owner. This is my mind, and you people work for me. Turns out they don't. And so, to me, I'm not bowing to anybody. More bowing to, I guess you could say, my own Buddha nature, or if you get a glimpse of what lies beyond the ego, you may have the experience, that most people do who get those glimpses, that you don't really get to live there. That you get some great fodder for Dharma talks, but in many ways go back to feeling the world and experiencing the world quite similarly to how you used to, or, you know, some period in a big mind, some period in a small mind. And that small mind, you know, when I do the bows alone, I do the Tibetan tradition where you throw yourself on the ground at the end. The idea of that small mind being subservient to really anything, it doesn't matter what, anything that won't hurt me, you know. Buddha's fine. Elvis works just great. You know, any deity, anybody who's not alive and is going to, you know, somebody who's alive might not be worthy of your absolute subservience, but, so, you know, the idea of throwing yourself down on the ground is really freeing to me, you know. It's so painful to think that the ego is in charge, and it's so impossible to give up thinking that for very long, and it just feels like a great weight off my chest, a great release of the pain to be able to throw him down, you know. It even feels a little good to him, because he knows he's not behaving very well. He just doesn't know how to do anything different, you know? He's had exactly one function his entire life, and that's all he's good at. So that's what I wanted to say about bowing. What else should we talk about? Yes, please. I'm sorry, what's your name?
Leslie.
Leslie, hi.
Sometimes in psychology books...
Oh, here, let me give you that.
Sometimes in psychological books, they'll talk about your true self.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure either they're talking about something that doesn't exist, or they're talking about something that does exist. And I'm wondering, is that our Buddha nature? And I know that might be a difficult question to ask, to answer, because you're not reading the same book that I'm...
No, conveniently, I have a PhD in clinical psychology, so I may actually be able to answer this question. Okay, that works. It reminds me of what Ivan was saying yesterday about, self-consciousness sounds like a bad thing, but here we talk about it as a good thing. So, what is the true self? Well, there's a couple ways we could think about this. I was thinking yesterday about, some of my friends who've been meditating for a long time, and seeing the changes in them, and also seeing the lack of changes in certain aspects, areas where I could point to them and say, you're still screwing this up, this is still delusional. I have no idea what I would point to myself at about that, if you spend a week with me, I'm sure you could come up with plenty. So, in meditation, there's sort of these two complementary paths of what we might call the mundane insight, the super mundane insight, right? So, I might ask your 10 best friends about you, and they might all say something that you might not say, something that's obvious to others but not obvious to you. And so if in meditation you start coming to see your own mind more deeply, we could call this approaching a true self, or getting a truer self. We can also think, both in terms of psychotherapy and in terms of meditation, we often kind of trace our suffering down almost like a tree, So you have this leaf out there that... that really attractive person on the meditation retreat with you has a wedding ring on, something like that. And maybe this leaf is on a branch, right? And the branch is, I feel lonely, right? And there's a whole bunch of different leaves coming off this branch. And when you see I feel lonely, all of a sudden these 10 leaves, right, the suffering about the person with the wedding ring and the, whatever else is on that loneliness leaf, right, that everybody's not talking to you and staring at the ground, and you might start thinking they're mad at you because you're not getting any attention, All these leaves kind of fall away when you see this branch. And this is probably on a bigger branch and a bigger branch, and when you get down to the trunk of the, not of the whole self, but at least of the suffering mind, you start seeing what in psychology we might call core negative beliefs, I'm not a lovable person. I'm worthless. I'm not good at anything, one of my patients said last week. I'm literally the worst person ever. And he was describing a voice in his head that I have in mine also, so I've been thinking about him a lot this week. So you can see how, as you might get down to, I feel lonely, right? Beneath that, maybe being, I'm not a lovable person, it's kind of a truer thing about yourself, right, than the jealousy about the wedding ring. A lot of what we do in the Dharma practice is take a really lousy, inaccurate, misery-inducing version of reality, model of reality, and substitute it with a slightly less inaccurate, slightly less misery-inducing theory of reality, rinse and repeat. And this is actually great, sort of living the ineffable truth all the time. This would be a pretty tall order, and moving in a progressively better, progressively better direction of models, this is a good way to go. So, we haven't quite gotten to the heart of the question of what is the true self, more so as we all have inaccurate pictures of ourselves, inaccurate understandings of ourselves. And in meditation, we can move closer and closer to an accurate understanding of ourselves. The idea of the true self in a purely mundane context, this really doesn't exist. And even our psych research has, for quite a few decades, shown us that this doesn't really exist, right? The person that you are with someone you're in love with might really feel like your true self. When you go back home to visit your parents, that's you too, you know? what we see is that we are very different depending on the context, certainly the outside context, the relational context, biological context, right? Is you with the flu particularly similar to you right now? If I hit you in the head, where's your true self, right? Well, it might not be very similar if I hit you in the head. So from a Buddhist sense, we might think of the mundane self as being conditional, right? If I took out any part of your brain, you would probably find that you, had a different true self than the one that you had before. In fact, there's a surgery that's sometimes done for grand mal seizures called a colostomy, something like that. Basically, it's two halves of the brain. What's the term, Renee? Is it colostomy? Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, it's, I can't really recall, but...
Anyways.
Anyways,
so the brain's got two lobes. Yeah. You're probably familiar with this. And pretty much the only connection is this strand of fibers. And you can cut this strand of fibers. And what you find in a patient where you do this is for the most part they function quite normally. It's a little creepy. You know, we think about oneself. If I cut your brain in half, you probably wouldn't notice that much of a difference. Your mental processes are so disintegrated, so disunified, so running in parallel. In everyday tasks, somebody with two brains is just as good as somebody with one. But you bring them into the lab, and you can do experiments where you find that there are actually two separate selves in there. They both function, they both do their thing, and one doesn't know what the other one is doing. Creepier still, if you show one what the other is doing, so for instance, I can never remember which side of the, which hemisphere does which thing or whatever, but left brain is, I guess,
analytical.
Left is the analytical, okay.
Right is more...
So one of them's got vision, one of them's got writing, you know. Mm-hmm. So show you a picture of a spoon with the word cow, and I say, you know, please draw this, and you draw a cow, and you say, what word do you see? I see the word spoon. Okay, well, why did you draw a cow? Spoons make me think about ice cream, and milk comes from cows, and so I guess I was thinking about a cow because of the ice cream. We all do this. So what is the true self? Well, there isn't one. The idea of the mind system model, a lot of it comes from a book a few decades ago by somebody who was writing about artificial intelligence. And he talks about it as sort of hierarchical, you know, so that you can sort of split any sub-mind into sub-minds below that, and sub-minds below that, and turtles all the way on down. And this is largely the Buddhist model of self also, is it's a bunch of hierarchical components with no central true self. Okay, so what are we all doing in meditation? Is the great realization of enlightenment that you are nothing but an accident of the cosmos, an automaton determined by these various processes in your brain, and at least you can stop worrying about it now? Yes. No, that's that's not true. So the psychology idea of a true self, I think, is bunk, and I think psychology research would probably show that it's bunk. The Buddhist idea of a true self, Buddhists are really into talking about non-self. At the time that the Buddha was teaching, Brahmanic religion, which is the predecessor to Hinduism, was the dominant religion in the areas he was teaching, and they had a true self, the Atman Brahman, where your true self has a union with God or Brahma or the infinite, and then you get the ultimate answer. And so there's all these sutras where the Buddha is arguing with these people, and he says, oh, no, no, the true answer is no self, not true self. And in the Buddhist sutras, he wins all of these arguments. So unsurprisingly, in the Jain sutras, he loses all of these arguments. His biographers were his fans, and Mahavira's fans were biographers were his fans. So this idea of the Atman Brahman, the true self versus the no self, these are different ways of talking about something that you absolutely cannot talk about. You can't talk about it because the whole structure of language simply falls apart when you try to, right? I have no way to communicate with you except in sentences. And all my sentences have a subject, a verb, and an object. And when you see the true self, there is no subject, there is no object, and I don't know what you would do with a verb without a subject or object to link the two. Language is inherently predicated on me over here and you over there and some relationship between us that we can describe. This is why it's sometimes called the ineffable, although the Dalai Lama once said, after all, though, it's not that ineffable. So people have been talking about this since time immemorial. There's lots of different ways you can come at it. In the Digha Nikaya, which is one of the books from the Pali Canon, the oldest Buddhist text that we have, there's the Sutra of the Elephant, the Blind Men and the Elephant. Probably a lot of people have heard this one, where somebody says to the Buddha, why is it that all these wise men describe the truth differently? And he says, well, suppose there are a bunch of blind men feeling up an elephant, right? And so one person's going to say it feels like a tube, and one, you know, somebody's feeling a trunk, and they say it feels like one thing, and somebody's feeling a leg, and they say it's going to feel like something else. And so everybody's coming at it with different descriptions, because it's awfully large. It also... Chila Dasa was talking, I think maybe yesterday, about trying to know the mind of God. And the viewpoint he's taking right now is that you can't know the mind of God. It's simply too big. I'm a little more optimistic. I would say that maybe you could. It just doesn't fit, you know? The mind of God cannot drive a car. The mind of God is not going to get your body to walk from here to over there. There are realms of consciousness that are just too big to fit in a human mind that is required to do the things that a human mind does, you know? An elephant couldn't drive my car, right? He's too big. The thing would get destroyed as soon as he sat down. So the nature of the true self, this one has been described a lot of different ways. The Buddha usually describes it as a nirvana, describes it in the negative, right? So, well, it's the absence of such and such, so the absence of craving, it's the absence of this, the absence of that. Other mystics talk about it in terms of unity and oneness, that the true self is, maybe God's a good way of talking about it, right? The true self is everyone and everything united, combined, that it's all one sort of force, it's all one unified energy field, and to us it manifests as different things. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about it as the waves in the ocean. You can look at the ocean, you can say, you know, there's a tall wave, there's a short wave, but it's all water, simply unchanging water moving up and down. And you can view it either in terms of the variety of waves or in terms of the, metaphorically at least, immutable, immortal totality of the water in the ocean. So as far as what we have to say about true selves, mostly metaphors, confusion. There is certainly something beyond the ego. And Chila Dasa was my second teacher. I was studying with a lady named Sharon Salzberg in a quite different tradition for maybe 5 years. And part of what sold me on studying here was there were a lot of people here who had pulled back the curtain, you know? Not a bunch of Buddhas walking around, but a bunch of people here who had pulled back the curtain and who hadn't lived in caves for 10 years and who weren't 91 years old, no offense, but people who, with some reasonable investment of time at a fairly young age, were able to pull back the curtain. I don't mean that as an offense to other traditions. In most traditions, this isn't something you're allowed to talk about. And so whether people do this or not is something that in most traditions you don't ever find out. If you do have this sort of experience, you're encouraged never to tell anyone. I've never figured out why. In the time of the Buddha, everybody knew what experiences everybody had. You, a group of people would show up and they would be described as, well, there's, you know, 6 non-returners and 7 once-returners and things like that. So keep going. You're in an auspicious place. If you haven't pulled back this curtain yet, you're in an auspicious place to do this, in a place where lots of people have done this. And if you have pulled back the curtain and you find that the damn thing just keep blowing shut on you again, well, keep pulling it back. What else are you going to do? Yes, Andrea.
Not
hold it right up.
Okay, not having pulled back the curtain myself, but you know, keen to. I know because of the whole ineffable thing, it's hard for my puny mind to even conceive what it would be like to see my world that way, the way that a stream enter or someone who's realized would. And I'm wondering, just not talking right now about precepts and stuff like that, because, you know, I sort of got those covered, but just this week even, just as I'm observing, how might I try that on? Like, what are some ways I could imagine that space, how somebody who is highly realized would see the world, just so I can, I'm always trying to just soften up the ego self.
And, yeah.
You know, see if I can, you know, trick it.
Step one would probably be a change in attitude. So, the truth is available in every moment equally. That feels impossible, so it bears repeating. The truth is available in every moment equally. And so the idea of the truth lying in the future through some new practice Chula Dasar or Renee or I might give you some new practice, or that there would be some way to do something differently and experience it. Well, maybe. But the crux of it is it's happening right now. In certain Buddhist traditions, particularly some Soto Zen schools, there's very little instruction. There are no roadmaps. There's a lot of sit there, see what happens, you know what you're doing. We could consider that maybe one extreme of the continuum. The other extreme of the continuum might be, maybe we want to pass up that binder rope? No, I'm just kidding. The other extreme of that continuum is what we are all doing right now, which is there are stages. Oh, you're at stage 4. That's really not as good as stage 6. And you should probably, when you were at stage 6 last week, but not anymore, my condolences. in the last couple months, a few of Chula Dasa students have started coming to my sangha. And what I've been finding is, you know, every system has pros and cons. That a big con of this one is this over-attachment to stages and to progress, which is a massive impediment, you know. There's a famous Ram Dass book, you know, Be Here Now. The idea of you should be in stage 10 is like inherently be there later, right? Because you're because you're not there right now. I'll button this thing, the microphone will work better. All right, cool. So the Buddha, is this projecting?
Mm-hmm.
All right, great. Okay. The Buddha talks quite a lot in the sutras about dependent origination. He says, someone who understands dependent origination understands this Dharma, and someone who understands the Dharma understands dependent origination. And the most critical part of dependent origination is the dependent origination between craving and ego. That we want something, or maybe to start a step back, something makes us feel good, or something makes us feel bad. I'm much more of a craving type. The Abhidharma classifies people into the craving, aversive, and delusive type. So I'm a craving type, so it's much easier for me to talk about we feel something good. Okay. So we feel something pleasant, and the next thing is we want more of that thing. And following we want more of that thing is this sort of belief and identification complex, right? So tana, craving, is just there all the time. It's a constant background noise. Make something different, make something different, make something different, make something different. You've probably all experienced that this week. But what it does is it grabs some particular thing in the world, right? Well, they're attractive, right? Let's get that thing, right? And so we can spend 15 minutes in meditation thinking about this attractive person we're going to get. And then all of a sudden, now we'd like some cake. And, 15 minutes on cake. And then the food here is so good, we can obsess about that. But then we're eating too much because it's, like, damn delicious. And it's unlimited in nature. And now we're feeling fat. And so what you're experiencing is tana, this purely mental process of make something different, grabbing something in the world and saying, this is the thing we need to make different. This is happiness. It keeps grabbing different things. We don't tend to notice that, right? We tend to believe, oh yes, this is the thing that I need to make different. And as soon as there's a thing you need to make different, well, now the world is split, right? I am over here. More of that kale salad is over there. And excuse me, I'm going to go get some, right? And now we have separateness. So part of what's meant by dependent origination is the whole idea of yourself as a separate entity is inextricably bound up with, co-creates is maybe the way to say it, the idea of you as a separate self and the idea of craving, tana, changing things. These co-create each other. The Buddha talks about sheaves, straws stacked up. And if you pull one away, they would all fall down. And it's the same way. If you pull down the tana for 1 second, for one half of 1 second, the whole house falls down. And some unholy wind of Mara, the evil one, will build the damn thing up for you again in half a second, but that's a good half a second. So how do you make that happen? Well, the short answer is, if I had an answer I could give you, I'd be a very wealthy man right now. I would be on Oprah right now and not out here in the desert. But the short answer would be, the more you can dig this present moment, the closer you are. The more that you can bring up appreciation, joy, love, acceptance of exactly what's going on right now with no exceptions, this is starting to move your mind in that direction. If you look in your meditation, you'll probably find that there are certain things in the world that you absolutely will not live in, you know? A world where a rock hits me in the head and I live to be 90, but I am a vegetable, you know? This feels like a world I refuse to live in, right? But we live in a world where that may easily happen, right? It may easily happen to any of us. If you look at that threshold for what sort of world you refuse to live in, it's going to be really low, right? Dinner's not till 5:30. I refuse to live in a world where I have to wait 3 hours for my next meal. Watch in your practice how low of a threshold you have for rejecting the present moment, for rejecting the entire world because of some tana. So the more that you say, I will live in this world no matter what, you know, it's the same thing as the bowing. It's what I mean by the bowing. You're in charge. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter what I call you. You're bigger than me. You're a lot more powerful. You're in charge, not me. Whether it's, you know, God, Jesus, Buddha, fate, karma, Elvis, or science, something bigger than you that is in charge is a way of saying, I will be okay with whatever happens. And if you truly can get to a place of one instant where everything in the world is okay, where you are not at war with anything, this joy, this appreciation, these factors of enlightenment, right? Joy, happiness, concentration, mindfulness, tranquility,
equanimity.
Equanimity. And,
investigation?
Thank you! Give that lady a sticker. The more that you accept the present moment, the more these factors of enlightenment become available, become the way that your mind works. The idea of the stages is that you're building the right sort of mindset to see the truth. And you are, you know, it works. It's why I'm here. The stages work, they work great. But enlightenment comes out of any stage or no stage. There are cases of people with absolutely no spiritual practice attaining sudden awakening. And so what I've been finding in a bunch of the interviews I've been doing is things like, well, I used to be at stage such and such, and now I'm at stage such and such divided by two, and I need to get back up to that first one. My experience more and more is, it's better for me to be in the lower stages, you know? That I'll get to a higher stage and something will knock me out and I'll get stuck down in a lower one. And the work I'm doing in these lower ones is way more important, you know? Tucker with perfect concentration and joy, bliss, and equanimity, like, he's not the one causing all my troubles, you know? Getting him more joyful, blissed out, and equanimous, I don't mean to be too derisive. You know, this is setting up the mind in the right sort of way to see the truth. But on the flip side, it's these more basic processes, you know, these guys that knock you down into stage two, these girls that knock you down into stage two, whatever gender you give your subminds. These are the ones that really need the work. These are the ones worth working on. And so if you take the stage model this way, it's not progressive. It's simply a set of directions for wherever your mind happens to be right now. And if you come to complete love and acceptance of where you are right now, how your mind feels right now, how your body feels right now, the weather, food, and all the rest, you can then use the stage model as a great way to help along the parts of the mind that are farther back while practicing this acceptance. So I think in terms of a short answer of how do you start experiencing the world that way, it would be non-craving, acceptance, surrender, whichever one of these words makes the most sense to you.
So you touched on joy, and I used to have a problem where I felt like I was trying to selectively choose joy or pleasure in the meditation practice, let's say, in particular, felt as if it were a craving. And I had to figure out how that wasn't a craving because I was just like, because it wasn't really functioning. And to me, my personal experience is that cultivating the joy, noticing the pleasure, has always been helpful in the meditation practice as well as in any moment. So I finally just came to a place where I agreed that the joy, the equanimity, the contentment, the pleasure, that kind of quality, those kinds of qualities were much closer to the truth than the qualities of aversion and discontentment. And so it wasn't the same as a craving for a chocolate cake. But what I would like you to speak to that, because it's come up today when we were in interviews today too, and it came to me that to remember to cultivate that at the very beginning of sitting down in a place like retreat where we're sitting a lot, and how useful that can be in unifying the mind. Could you comment to that?
Yeah, please. Yeah, I'd love to. So, Buddhism gets thrown in with the New Age movement a lot, with positive psychology, and the idea that we should look on the happy side. This is absolutely not what Buddhism is about. The first noble truth is life is dukkha, right? Life is suffering. Life is unsatisfactory. The idea that you should put a positive spin on everything and look on the happy side. This is largely the opposite of the Buddhist path. One story I heard about why Buddhists and other Asian cultures do this is that this symbolizes the lotus blossom. And the lotus only grows in the mud. If you don't have the mud, the blossom can't rise above the water. So what we're doing in practice is investigating. It's one of the two factors of enlightenment, I forgot. Is investigating the mind. All of the mind, impartially and accurately. So we don't want to ever be sort of looking for the positive and avoiding the negative. This is what Buddhists would call delusion. It's not seeing out of craving. The sutras talk about the eight worldly dharmas, or the eight vicissitudes, or the eight worldly winds. Pain and pleasure, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. And it's sort of like these eight things, or these four dipoles of things, sort of like the stock market. You know, they're just going to go up and down forever, and everybody's cheering for one direction, right? Everybody is attached to more gain, less loss, more praise, less blame. And this doesn't lead to joy. It leads temporarily to positive feelings, but what I think we mean in this tradition by joy, it doesn't come from that. It comes from actually the opposite. So you'll hear a hippy-dippy types, I guess like myself sometimes, talk about joy as being our true nature, you know, our natural state of being. And I think this is true. It's the craving after the pleasure and not the pain that comes between us and that sort of experience. That rather than craving the pleasure or craving for the pleasure and aversion for the pain, sutras often use the word dispassion. That maybe radical acceptance would be better than dispassion. You know, a radical acceptance towards both the pleasure and the pain. This is something that starts to lead to joy. You know, so you're sitting here on your cushion, and you're getting kind of concentrated, and you're feeling sort of nice, and then the dullness comes up. Right? Or then the pain in your knee comes up. Oh, if only I could make that go away, right? That is you. It's not all of you. It's a very small part of you. But it is inherently you. And any time you want to kill a part of yourself, this is an inherently suicidal tendency, you know? This is a split of one's own personality. Joy cannot come from trying to take one part of oneself and kill the other part of oneself. And this is the way that we spend most of our time, you know? So a psychologist in Reno talks about it as a mental chess game, right? Where the white pieces are your good thoughts and the black pieces are your bad thoughts. And you're trying to play checkmate, right? You're the only person playing, right? This is a war where you are the only combatant and the only possible options are losing the game, or I guess continuing to lose the game, or don't play the game anymore. And so I would see this as the difference between joy as the enlightenment factor and craving as the opposite of enlightenment. Is joy is something that naturally arises from love, acceptance and love being nearly identical. If you let something be exactly how it is, no matter how it is, it's virtually the same as love. And self-love is a good place to start. The more that you come to develop self-acceptance and self-love, the more clearly you can see what your mind actually looks like. This is probably why joy is an enlightenment factor, you know? It just makes you feel smarter. It makes you be able to see more clearly. If you imagine if a friend of yours is having a tragedy, and you're crying about a tragedy that you've had, and they come to you to talk, how do you receive them? Versus when we leave this retreat, and we're all blissed out and glowing, and somebody comes over to you with a problem, how do you receive them then? Right? When you're in a state of joy, you receive this troubled friend, much more likely to receive them with warmth, acceptance, compassion. And it's the same in our minds. Whatever comes up, positive, negative, beautiful, ugly, right? We've got all of it. whatever comes up, you can accept it, investigate it, see it truly, be here with it. The more that you cultivate this joy. And of course, the idea of dependent origination is everything co-creating everything else, right? Or the whole universe as a, the whole universe is interlocking feedback loops. The more joy you have, the more easily you greet sorrow, so the more joy you have. And vice versa, the more you need this part of yourself to go away, the more self-rejection you have, the more delusion you have, and the more you need that other part of yourself to go away. When you come to see yourself more and more clearly, you'll start seeing how similar you are to everybody else. Or maybe more accurately, this idea of a seed I like a lot, that whatever anybody else is doing, those seeds exist in you as well. Perhaps you've watered different ones. A couple years ago, somebody in here was talking about a murder, and they said, I just can't understand why that person would kill these innocent people. I thought, well, of course you can, right? Everybody can. Everybody knows what deep anger and deep hatred are like, you know? And the more you investigate your own mind, the more you'll see anger and hatred in there. Deep, deep anger and hatred. The kind of thing that if watered, if you lived in a community and a culture where this was something that was valued, you could easily do it. Anything that you see in somebody else, you probably have that seed in your own mind somewhere. Even if you are extremely different from them, incapable of acting the way they act, you can certainly understand why they act the way they act. And so the more you come to see your own mind, the easier it is to be open and compassionate to others, the easier it is to understand others. And this is often what we see from wise Dharma teachers, right? We see people who look pretty happy in their own lives and who, without Lyme disease, don't seem to tire easily of hearing other people's troubles, you know, having an open heart for whatever you bring to them. What's your name?
Grace.
Grace, hi.
Should it be red? Or does it work?
Yes. Okay.
Can I just be devil's advocate for a second?
Sure.
Because I feel like we're so, our tendency towards seeing the negative is so strong. So just to get it to sort of balance out enough to just be able to get to a place of being able to be more... I don't know. I mean, I really have a huge problem with the idea of objectivity anyway, mm-hmm. but whatever this is where it feels like you're kind of stepping back, you know, and seeing more than you did when you were so invested in being a particular point of view, you know, whatever that is, mm-hmm. just to get closer to that, it seems like it's really useful to me anyway, to be like, when I'm in the midst of just hating somebody, looking for like, but what is it about like, you know, if I really hate his behavior right now, what is it about him that I can relate to or understand? Or, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that
yeah.
kind of looking for what's good in a situation, I think, can be really helpful.
Yeah, so I teach these eight-week intro meditation classes a lot, and there's this game I like to play on the first week where I say, look at the person to your left. Imagine that next week they come in, and they say they have not done their meditation homework even once. They were really busy. What would you think? What would you say to them? People say, oh, you know, we all get busy. You know, try again later. It's about the practice. And I say, okay, suppose next week you come in and you say, I didn't do the meditation even once. Are you thinking, that's okay, buddy, right? And nobody is thinking that, right? What's going through your head? Asshole, loser, screws everything up. Everyone hates you, right? Is that the tendency that most of us have? Is to treat ourselves with a degree of cruelty that is absurd, right? A degree of cruelty that we would not wield towards the person we hated the most in the world. It feels very natural to just talk about ourselves this way. And this seems to be, particularly in the West, a very, very common situation. There's a story where Jack Horn, I think it's Jack, asks Ajahn Chah, Why do you, Ajahn Chah was his teacher in Thailand, why do you give opposite advice to people? And he said, well, if your car is drifting to the left of the road, I'm going to tell you to steer right, and if his car is drifting to the right, I'm going to tell him to steer left. Something I say in the song I teach a lot is, there are no ultimate truths here, there are only course corrections. And so, both of these things can be true at once as course corrections, right? A mind that is mired in the negative needs to get out, right? Whether the way out of hell is through or backwards, you have to get out. There's an experience called the Dukkhanyanas, or we often use a Christian term, the dark night of the soul. And it's something caused by certain types of meditation, conveniently, generally not Chula Dasa's style of meditation. And it can last for years of really deep, deep darkness. And for me, this lasted for 3 years. And the other suffering that I've had in my life has felt helpful, you know, character building, wisdom inducing. Probably most of us, we think about our tragedies, would we go back in time and avert them? If they were long enough ago, you'd probably say no, right? Then they help make you who you are. This dark night was a waste of time, you know? 3 miserable years with nothing good coming out of it. And so the mind certainly can get to a place of negativity where the course correction advice is the exact opposite, right? Walking meditation, look at the mountains, right? Put on a CD of nice music. So yes, certainly there is that course correction. The other thing I would say, though, it's another thing that I love about this style of practice that's drawn me here, is the idea of Chula Dasa's attention and awareness. I usually go with foreground and background, because then you don't have to, you know, people aren't familiar with those terms. So how do you see the negative objectively? Well, good luck, you know. Good luck getting over an old relationship objectively. If you're laughing right now, it's because that's ridiculous. This isn't something that happens objectively. So the goal isn't to become sort of a cold, frigid scientist watching the thawing of your own heart. metaphorically. The idea is, can you put whatever is relevant right now in the foreground of your attention without losing the context? There's quite a few sutras where the Buddha uses the same metaphor. He says, consciousness is the seed. Let's go from the other direction. Karma is the field. Consciousness is the seed. Craving and clinging are the moisture. So if I say, how are you right now? If we were off retreat, we'd probably have some quick answer, right? Good, bad. Some quick story of who we are, what we are comes to mind. After a couple weeks of retreat, how are you becomes about the most challenging koan you've ever heard, right? How are you? Well, I can identify about 10,000 distinct sensations in this present moment. There's a near infinite sequence of present moments in the past minute. Which of these storylines do you want me to tell you, you know? Well, the food's really good, it's beautiful here, the meditation's good. I've been eating too much, I feel kind of bloated, it's cold, the heaters don't work great, you know. Whatever. If you want to tell the story about who you are right now, how are you, who are you, you don't have an infinite array to choose from, right? None of us get to pick NBA star, to the best of my knowledge. But you have a really vast potential of what you can choose to be, identify with, describe yourself as. This tendency, though, is to plant the seed of consciousness at one tiny little spot in the field and dump lots of craving and clinging on it so that it grows into a plant that is stuck in exactly one spot and can see only that one spot. I probably don't need a show of hands to know who finds this phenomenon familiar. So what's the idea? Well, you can't sort of be the whole field of karma all the time. This might feel very nice, but you'll crash into the car in front of you. What I really love about this tradition is you can see the negative in the attention without allowing the context to collapse, right? We have this background awareness. Sharon talks about it as looking at a cloud in the sky. And if you can see the vastness of the sky, even a really big cloud isn't such a big problem, right? If you see the enormity of the context, even something extremely painful isn't all that bad, right? Of the things that this practice has done for me, that's been maybe one of the one or two most successful things that the practice has done for me. It's very rare that the context completely collapses anymore, because I spend all this time trying to have something in the attention and everything else in the background. So to give a summary answer to your question, yes, there are states of mind where all you want is a course correction towards the positive, you know? When we get depressed, we have negative attentional bias, we have negative attributional bias, so we're only seeing negative things. Whatever we're seeing, we're interpreting as a negative thing, even if it's not. And something to pull you out of that is very helpful. Something to bring up happiness in the mind is very helpful. But we do need to see the whole mind. That is the idea. You can't only live as a part of yourself and hope to pull back the curtain, right? When you pull back the curtain, you are far, far vaster than you've ever imagined. And if what you have right now is too much, don't pull the curtain back. You know, it's gonna get a lot worse. You don't much like what you have here, and you suddenly find out it's infinite, immortal, and immutable. Yeah, maybe that's what I have to say about that.
So what would you say is the role of, like, silence here? You know, like, when we're not meditating, when we're not doing something obvious, like eating that we can meditate upon, like, what should we be doing? And, like, why is, like, silence important?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's particularly relevant for me, too. The other time I did this, co-taught a retreat out here, it was like a 1-week retreat, and I was on a 4-week retreat, so it felt okay. Like, now this is my whole retreat, and I have to keep talking. So I'm finding, you know, so much craving for silence. So silence is probably, among the spiritual traditions of the world, the most ubiquitous tradition you will find. Sacred spaces are usually silent spaces. Prayer and meditation often involve components of unusual amounts of silence. To me, part of the silence is just feels good, you know? When I talk about the craving for it, when you sit quietly, especially a place like out here where there's just not a lot of sound, you know, it feels really nice to me. But this isn't really the point. The ego has a mind of its own. Maybe more accurately, the ego is a mind of its own. And it is booby-trapped. It is surrounded by defenses. And Chula Dasa was talking about this yesterday, that as you get close to a realization, you start stepping in these booby traps, you know? These defenses start coming out. Somebody asked a great question about false insights. And these are among the numerous defense mechanisms that we have to prevent from seeing the truth. Why don't we want to see the truth? Well, a smaller part of it is you would be awfully weird if you saw the truth. The Buddha says the Dharma goes against the grain. When he first attains enlightenment, he decides he's not going to teach. He says this is too radical. No one will be able to understand this. A lot of people will not be able to understand this. And the culture that each of us lives in, no matter where on this planet we live, is constantly reinforcing the opposite of the truth, right? Oh, you're in a happy relationship. That's really great. It's like, well, actually, sort of suffering in, suffering out, you know. Every little comment about, I like your shirt. You must be really happy to have a nice shirt like that. It's hard to have any sort of interaction with somebody without them telling you that getting good things is making you happy, and not getting good things or getting bad things is making you unhappy. watch that when we leave and you have a conversation, how many times in that conversation someone is telling you this. So some part of why we don't want to see the truth is it makes you awfully weird, and it makes it really hard to talk to most people because their viewpoint is so much the opposite. I would say the bigger reason we don't want to see the truth is that we really believe that this ego, this small self, is the real self, the only self. And when you start getting close to pulling back the curtain, you can have these experiences of dying, or even worse than dying. It feels like killing your soul, you know, something worse than suicide, as you come to exposing the phoniness of the thing that feels like it is truly you. Beyond this is the whole tree of suffering, right? So at the root of it is this craving ego kind of co-creating ball. But there's this whole tree of other things that trigger us, that set us off, that make us become defensive, that make us want to hide instead of seeing the truth. And so monks keep silence. The Theravadin monks take an awful lot of precepts and rules. But some of the core ones are things that we're observing on the retreat, right? Not speaking unless it's absolutely necessary. Not having sex. Not engaging in anything entertaining. And the reason is, all of these things are one more way not to have to notice what's going on in your own mind. Not that these things are inherently bad, certainly, right? But a break from them is a way of having nowhere to hide, right? You can't go read a book, you can't go talk to somebody, you can't go on the internet, or if you do, you have to go someplace where we can't see you because we'll all be judging you. And even if we don't see you, you'll feel our judgment. We could also do a show of hands of how many people have been convinced that the others on the retreat were judging them while they've been out here. Probably all of us. So this is the point of the silence. There's nowhere to run, there's nowhere to hide, there's nothing to do except see. So your other question was, okay, what do we do when it's not meditation time? There are some retreats where the schedule has only meditation time. Or actually, most of the retreats I've been on have only meditation or specific tasks. You know, so you take a shower and you eat your meals. But many retreat schedules actually don't involve any breaks in them. I think to a large degree what you do on the breaks doesn't matter. The breaks aren't very long. The healing, the transformation that's coming on this retreat is something that's continuing 24 hours. Probably a lot of us will start experiencing intrusions into sleep, you know, having dreams about the sorts of changes that are going on. Waking up absolutely wide awake at 4 a.m. for a few hours, things like that. So these transformations are happening. Willpower is never, ever, ever what is making these transformations happen. Willpower, the ego, its only real job is to claim it's fixing the problem while actually exacerbating the problem. The more you give it to do, the more it will do this. So it's sort of a balance again, right? So on one hand, we don't want too little effort, right? We don't want to sort of spend the day lying in bed reading something vaguely about the Dharma and convincing ourselves that this is retreat. Because we're all here, I'm guessing that none of us are falling very far towards that edge of not doing the work, right? Because we're all attracted to this sort of Dharma teaching, I'm guessing that all of us are falling too far to the other end, right? How do I do something, will something, make something different? And so if you find that you're falling too far to that end, the break's a nice time to chill out. And as long as you're doing things that are, kusala is the Pali word. It's like things that are wholesome, helpful, wholesome, helpful, things that don't create bad karma, you know, looking at the mountains, hanging out with my chickens, going for a walk, whatever. As long as you're doing something wholesome, you know, probably most of us could use the relaxation. You may get to a place in the retreat, particularly if this isn't your first retreat, where it's quite the opposite, where you're feeling so good, so high, so mindful, that a break feels terrible. The idea of relaxing would be deliberately giving up something that's now coming to you quite naturally and easily. And in that case, of course, don't take the break. So consider the Dharma Talks optional, starting after this one. Dharma Talks are optional. In fact, for a day at a time, maybe, food is optional. I'll sometimes do a fasting day when I get to a place where the mindfulness is just really feeling fantastic. So I would say, as far as the breaks, whatever feels right and isn't kind of pulling your mind in the direction of craving. So, sometimes it's fun to break lying in bed, dreaming about what I'm going to do on Saturday and things like that. Probably avoid that sort of thing as much as you can, because you'll be doing plenty of that anyways. But yeah, otherwise I think whatever feels nice, to treat the break as a break. You push all the way, hold it right up to your mouth.
It's
perfect. Yeah.
So this is something I've been wondering about, and I maybe have a short answer for. So there's this possibility of insight and seeing things that are the way they really are for us.
Mm-hmm.
Some people achieve. But there's no... there's no reproductive fitness associated with that.
Quite the opposite.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's no benevolent God that gave this to us as a gift. So why is it possible? Why is it there?
That might be fun to talk about. So I go to a lot of meditation science conferences and things like that, and there was one I was at recently where somebody was talking about a computer modeling study where you are creating an organism and trying to make it live. And the question is, do you want the organism to see the truth about its environment, or do you want it to see only the utility in its environment, which is more adaptive? And the answer is, the only reason you would ever see something true is if by coincidence it happens to also be useful. Truth has absolutely no reproductive value, reproductive or survival value. So that's right. We've evolved to see things the way that we do, because if you were immortal and immutable, you wouldn't run from a mountain lion. So why is it possible if there's no benevolent God? So I will make no comment on whether there is or isn't a benevolent God. In fact, I would probably counter that with, well, what do you mean? If it's the dude with the white beard in heaven who grants wishes, probably most people don't believe in the dude on the throne up there. In terms of other meanings of God, I wouldn't want to go into whether we do or don't believe in that. It mostly becomes a definition of what that word means and how you parse it. But so, right, assuming that no outside entity has given us this to be nice to us, why is it possible? So, I guess one way you could think about it is, what does an earthworm do, right? Like an earthworm, mud in, poop out, and that's essentially an earthworm, right? There's not much course correction there. There's not all that much you can do wrong as an earthworm, right? Sunlight, bad, get down. As you start doing more complicated things, even pretty basic sorts of organisms, you need some sort of course correction mechanism, right? So if you are trying to shoot the target, you need the mechanism that, holds the thing and pulls the trigger and does the aiming. You also need the mechanism to let you know, did you aim it right? If you didn't aim it right, how do we move the aim? And so most organisms, as they get more complex, I guess all organisms as they get more complex, have to develop a course correction to get back to homeostasis when they lose it. It seems to me that humans have had to develop a third layer of this. So what happens when the course correction itself isn't working, So it's too cold out. Go inside when it gets cold, right? Well, okay, but it's an ice age now, and going inside doesn't make us any warmer. The course correction mechanism itself doesn't work. And this is obliteration for most species, right? All they know how to do when it's cold is go inside, and if it's cold inside, they'll just freeze to death inside. So I think that as humans, we've developed the ability to, what you can think of as this third level of analysis, is the ability to analyze the analyzing of the mind. And because we have this ability, it allows us to do incredibly complex tasks, right? If you want to distinguish how are humans different from other animals, there's not many ways you can do it, right? Other animals have speech, other animals seem to form relationships, they have similar DNA to us, they use tools. The main thing that I can see that differentiates us from other animals is the things we do are way, way, way more complex, right? Nothing else could handle the amount of steps it would take to build a lawnmower, right? Let alone a 747. And so with this ability to analyze the mind and correct the course correction, we can now actually start taking apart the machinery. It's actually possible now to open the thing up and see how it works. And this is where the truth comes from. The truth comes from, or one way you can talk about where the truth comes from, is seeing how the mind does what it does. And I think this would be the reason that humans probably uniquely have the ability to see how the mind works, because it has been advantageous to do more complex things. Like, we're not very big, we're not very fast, we don't bite hard, we don't have thick claws, we don't reproduce very quickly, you know. We don't have anything going for us except that. This thing's going to ring in 2 minutes, but we can take one more question if anybody has anything they want to say.
Can I just congratulate you for saying homeostasis in a Dharma talk?
Really? I would have thought that given the chair I'm sitting in, that would be a nickel word by now.
And, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so if somebody could give the microphone to Chelsea, please.
It felt like the last thing unsaid with that past, that just riff about, okay, no reproductive value, not helping us survive, but like, so you kind of answered how, like, we've developed the ability to sort of do this, but you, I think, stopped short of the why, which I guess, I mean, the simple is that, I mean, this can help us end suffering, and like, there's all sorts of fruits along the path, but I don't know, I guess just, it seemed like you sort of stopped short, like, it was a kind of like, this is pointless, this makes us weird, this is whatever, I guess. a few seconds of completing that last thought.
Yeah.
Awakening pep talk.
Yeah, so, there are two, at least two, sort of deepest goals of the path: seeing the truth and ending, or if not permanently ending, dramatically and irreversibly decreasing your ability to experience suffering. I think Shiva Dasa is the author of the metaphor of pulling back the curtain in The Wizard of Oz for how enlightenment is irreversible, right? You pull back the curtain and you see the man in the booth back there. And the next time you see that giant head in the sky, it's roughly as scary as it was the last time you saw it. And this is what I mean about, you know, talking about the straws falling down and then they build right back up. The next time you see that giant head in the sky, it's roughly as terrifying as it was last time. But you can never believe in it again, you know, no matter what effect it has on you, you know the truth, and you can't ever unknow that truth. So, between now and when you die, what would you like to do? Well, know the truth, probably a pretty popular goal. It's time, it's right on time, doesn't it? Probably knowing the truth would be a pretty popular goal. probably decreasing your own suffering, loving and connecting with people better, having more energy, more strength, more resolve to do the things that you want to do, being able to have a stable mind so that when you decide to do something, you actually follow through on that thing and can do it, understanding the world accurately enough, having enough strength, enough love to leave it a better place than when you started. I think if you asked most people, what do you want between now and when you die, they'd probably check at least one of those boxes, right? And so that is what the Dharma offers. The Dharma is actually offering a check on all of those boxes. Sometimes. There's a lot of speeches about all the wonderful things the Dharma will do for you, and everyone forgets to say sometimes. These, I think, become false advertising and lofty promises. But the sometimes can get wider and wider. And even if, I don't know, you had 10 seconds of perfect clarity and bliss, you know, probably be worth the week out here, right? Okay. So maybe we should go back to being quiet. Thanks for coming. You know, when you're the junior teacher, you never know. You never know who's going to show up. People come in and they see you and you get this look of Buddhist disappointment. Oh, you. Just what I paid for.